Hello and welcome to AUP Radio, a melting pot of voices and ideas, brought to you by World Radio Paris. Tonight we have two shows coming up. We'll start off with Forgotten History and then move on to We Need to Talk. Enjoy!
Hello, and welcome to Forgotten History. I'm your host, Isaac Bates, and today we have a guest listener. Kira, would you like to give us a brief introduction?
Hi, you know me. I'm the executive producer of AUP Radio, so you probably hear my voice a lot if you listen to this. But hey, how's it going?
It's going very well. I'm really glad to have you on here. So we're just going to try to, I'm not quite sure how to segue into this, but we'll get right into it. So when I tell you living dead, I guess, what comes to mind when I say those two words, living dead?
Zombies, yeah.
Zombies. Okay, I knew you were going to say that. What if I told you that there, you know, there's about maybe 100 people in the 1920s that were referred to as the walking, breathing, living dead. Do I have your curiosity?
You definitely. I'm intrigued.
Okay.
Where was this?
Well, this was right here. No, well, not right here. This was in the U.S. We're not. We're in France. But this was over there across the pond in the United States in a small town called Orange, New Jersey, and then a town not too far away from my hometown called Ottawa in Illinois. So these were two events happening at the same time, but, you know, they're not really related to each other as far as this wasn't a planned event or anything. I'm going to explain. This is all going to make sense. And the reason I say the words living dead is because, like I said, you know, back in this time, there was a large group of people. They were considered to be living dead because they were exposed to a very certain chemical at that time that was believed to be almost magical. You know, it was supposed to be very good for you. And this chemical is radium. Do you know anything about radium?
I know that it's used in nuclear bombs.
Yes, it's used in nuclear stuff. I don't know if it's... I don't know if it's used anymore. I think they might have discontinued its use. It's probably used somewhat in very scientific things.
I feel like they might be used in nuclear power plants, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not a nuclear physicist. I don't know either.
It's a speculation.
All right. Yes, all right. What really goes on out there? But anyway, so today we're going to be talking about the Radium Girls. All right, and so let me just start this story from the very beginning. You know, the U.S. enters World War I in 1917. And Kira, do you own a watch?
No.
No? You don't? Oh, that's surprising. Well, back then, there wasn't really a thing as I don't think it existed yet, the wrist watch. All right, it's mostly pocket watches at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And our U.S. soldiers, you know, they were fighting overseas. And they would you know, duck, cover, crawl, whatever, and their pocket watches would break inside their pockets, or they would fall out and get lost. And another problem of the pocket watch was also that, you know, you couldn't see them at night. You know, obviously there's nothing digital back then.
Oh, I think I see where this is going.
And so, you know, so over in the U.S. back at home, there were these two specific factories, one in Ottawa, Illinois, and one in Orange, New Jersey, and they specialized in making wristwatches. And they used this paint that could glow easily in the dark. And they made the paint out of radium. And like I said, this was acceptable at the time. Now we know that radium is extremely dangerous, but it was acceptable at the time because it was believed to have many health benefits. It was supposed to make your skin glow, make your hair grow, make you look healthy. They put it in water, right, as a filter.
Oh, my God.
They used it to treat cancer, which is kind of counterintuitive, I guess. And, yeah, there was in toothpaste. They made candy out of it. It was just they got it completely wrong at the time, this radium. And it was a fairly new element, so they didn't have much info, but still. And like I said, very deadly. And so these factories, they hired these women. And if you ever look at the watch, like my watch, back in the day, it was even more intricate. They would paint the little tick marks on there. But I don't know if you do much painting in your own time. When you paint, you know, you kind of want like to get that fine tip and then put the paint on the brush a certain way, make it nice and sharp so you can, you know, right. It's like you have a signature or whatnot. It's like the same concept.
Yeah.
The management, all male management, they were telling the girls, all female workforce, hey, you need to have this fine tip on your brush, okay? You need to have this fine tip on your brush so that when you paint the dial, it looks nice. It's very intricate. Like I said, it's precise and everything. And so to do this, they told these ladies, these are all very young ladies. They're like from ages 18 to 24. You even have some people as young as 16 in there, actually. They told them you need to use the lick, dip, paint method.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that. Oh, God.
Yes. So what these ladies would do is they would lick their brush, dip it into the radium paint. When the paint was off the brush, re-lick it over and over again. And they were doing this for 250 dials a day. So they were doing this
Jesus.
5 days a week, five and a half days a week.
My question is, why wouldn't they just like get a cup of water? Like that can't taste good.
Well, like I said at the time, so there's two reasons. They kind of go back into each other. Like I said, reason number one was these girls, they came onto the job thinking, man, I get to eat radium. I mean, it's not as black and white as that, but they're like, okay, this is radium and I'm going to be putting my mouth on this and it's not going to be a big deal because this stuff's good for you anyway.
Right.
And secondly, they just didn't have the information. And this was an extremely high-paying job for women at the time. If you had one of these jobs as a dial painter, especially at one of these two factories, you were in the top 5% highest income for a female in the United States at the time. So it was, you know, it's where you wanted to be as a woman, especially at such a young age as 18 through 24. Amazing job. Well, not really amazing seeing what happened to them. But anyway, so 1917, a few years go by, and this one girl, Amelia Molly Maggia, all right, she goes to the dentist one day, and she's like, man, I have this terrible toothache. Please help me. And the dentist assesses her teeth and is like, hey, we need to take out this tooth. It's infected. And so he comes in with, you know, whatever they use to pull teeth, and he pulls one out. And not only does he pull a full tooth out, but he pulls a piece of her jaw that came out with the tooth.
Oh, no. Absolutely not. That's horrible.
Yeah. And he's horrified, and he's like, okay, I've never seen anything like this, all right? And he doesn't know what to do. He you know, he just kind of fills it with gauze and is like, all right, I don't know how to treat you. And she ends up going, she doesn't work anymore, but she goes home. And, you know, she would come back to the dentist periodically, and they would pull more and more teeth. And on September 12th of 1924, she went to the dentist a final time, and her jaw crumbled before the dentist's hands.
How is that even possible?
It disintegrated. Well, the way radium works, all right, radium works just like calcium, apparently, from what I've read on the internet, all right? So, you know, the body absorbs the calcium and it sends it into the bones, all right? And then your bones use the calcium, makes the bones stronger, but radium does the complete opposite. It gets absorbed into the bones, and then it puts holes into your bones. It almost looks as if your bones are like this honeycomb structure, all right?
Oh.
And so a lot of these girls that were exposed to this radium that were doing this lick, dip, paint method all the time, they had this honeycomb bone-like structure, and their bones would actually break and fracture just from being touched, all right? Just from light pressure, you know, you pat someone on the back, you could kill them.
Oh, my God. This is horrible.
And one girl, you know, she, just from standing, her spine had, like, disintegrated a little bit. She needed a metal back brace just to stand up straight for the rest of her life, which her very short life, I may add. So more and more of these girls, they end up dying, all right? And so now, you know, some of these girls, they're looking, you know, they're feeling sick all the time. They're waking up in the middle of the night. They look into the mirror and they're like glowing, like no BS. They're actually glowing. They can see this. And they're, you know, every, you know, periodically a few of them will die here and there. And they're starting to think, hey, this is probably the radium. And a lot of other scientists and doctors are thinking the same thing. And these factories, you know, they're ran by some of the biggest radium companies in the U.S. at that time. They're going to try to keep it very hush-hush and on the down low. They're going to pay doctors to do fake research saying, hey, no, it's not the radium. They're going to go as far as to say that these girls are actually just dying from syphilis, which at the time had a very negative stigma behind it.
Mm.
And it was very prevalent in society at that time. A lot of people were dying of syphilis.
This is like the same thing as big tobacco a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Big radium.
Yeah, big radium. You know, those a-holes. And so these ladies, they're going to try to get lawyers and whatnot. They're going to try to get doctors on their side. But for years, they're not going to have much support. And then one doctor is going to come in, and he's going to, Dr. Cecil Drinker, he's going to come in, and he's the first doctor to step into these factories, and he's going to say, okay, this is very obvious that it's the radium doing this. All right, like, he knows a little bit about radium and whatnot, and he's saying there's radium dust everywhere. They're inhaling this, they're touching this. And then when he sees one of them lick it for the first time, he freaks out. There's a account of him actually smacking the brush out of a lady's hand. And so when these ladies, they get this knowledge, they're like, okay, these doctors, these scientists are saying this is bad. They're going to go to the management, and the management is going to, you know, gaslight them, downplay the whole situation. Hey, no, this is good, whatever. And it's still going to take a few more years. So, yeah, so they eventually do try to sue, and it didn't get much attention at first in New Jersey. And, you know, they had to get this one doctor on their side, and this guy was able to examine some of the patients, the alive ones, and he observed that these girls, they were actually exhaling radium gas.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
They were basically just absorbing it then.
Well,
they
were like, so radium has a half-life of like 1,600 years, all right? So, you know, you absorb it, and you're going to be getting poisoned by this radiation for years and years to come.
And then give it off to other people as well.
Yeah. And so he was able to actually, I don't know how he did it, but he was like, hey, every time you exhale a breath, man, there's radiation, like, that's ridiculous. You're dying. That's a walking nuclear plant or something. Jeez.
Like, not only are you dying, you're also, like, toxic to the people you're around.
And that's why they call them, you know, that is my point from earlier. They call them the living dead, because when you get to that point, you're like a walking sack of poison, pretty much. There's no hope for you. And these ladies, when the evidence came out, when they had more knowledge, they knew, okay, my days are very numbered. You know, a lot of them were bedridden. A lot of them, like I said, couldn't walk. A lot of them, most of them lost a lot of their teeth because, you know, affects the area you apply it to first. One girl, for some reason, her, you know, you would see a lot of cancer. You would see a lot of cysts and whatnot. One girl, one of her legs shrank like 6 inches than the other one. So you get a lot of strange things like that, but they knew that their days were numbered. And like, and bringing it back to that point where you're just like toxic, they glowed.
They were glowing.
They glowed in the dark. And they were called, you know, ghost girls, ghost women. And so this is just like evidence to how dangerous and poisonous this stuff really was. And to carry on, so this guy observes this is the first like actual real study that was published and wasn't, I guess, kind of denounced by the company. I'm sure it was denounced, but it was an independent study. It wasn't, you know, the other guy who came into the actual factories, he was hired by that company. And then when he produced the results that they didn't like, they kept his report secret. But this guy, he did a independent study, and so that was published, and you know the news went crazy about that. They started labeling these women radium girls, and then so they were fighting, like I said, for years. They were able to convince a very young lawyer at the time, Raymond Berry. He took the case pro bono, along with help from other doctors and other lawyers and whatnot. And they were able to sue U.S. Radium and the U.S. Dow Company back in Ottawa. And they each were awarded $150,000. In today's money, it was $10,000 back in the day. But most of these women, they could really only use that money for their own funerals, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's horrible. Yeah. Getting a big payout like that, just knowing you're going to die, like... I mean, everybody would love that much money, right?
Yeah.
But it's almost a slap in the face being like, yeah, we did this to you. So, I mean, here's some money. I guess give it to your kids. Like,
well, yeah. I mean, they had to, like, a lot of them were already dead.
Yeah.
A lot of them spent that money on medical bills, dentist bills. And the ones who, I guess, made it past that, they had to spend it on their funerals and their caskets and whatnot. It's just very terribly sad.
Yeah.
But there were some good things that came from this. So this was the marker that established the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, otherwise known as OSHA.
Have you ever done OSHA training before?
I have done OSHA training. Have you?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I've done OSHA and EPA.
I don't know what EPA is.
Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah, but what kind of training...
So I had to do both. When I did EPA, it was because I was handling like a bunch of oil and hydraulic fluid and other crazy stuff.
Okay.
Like radium, you know. Mm. But that's the type of training I got. Hey, you can't put this thing on your lips.
Like,
you know?
Yeah, please don't lick the hazardous material.
Yeah. So that's why this story, I guess it was very forgotten. They actually made a Netflix movie about this, which would probably do more justice than I would on the whole situation. But yeah, it established a lot of workers' rights. It really set the precedent, and it, you know, we got OSHA out of it, which is a huge deal in the States. And it was also one of the first times that workers really came together and, you know, took an actual case to the Supreme Court to try and get compensation.
And can you just remind me the year that this was all happening in, please?
So this started in 1917.
That's pretty late. Wow.
And like, you know, it wasn't taken into the Supreme Court until the 30s. I think the late 30s.
Wow. So this is less than 100 years ago. That's crazy.
Yeah, very recent. Well, anyway, Kira, thank you so much for coming on and listening to me talk about the Radium Girls. It's been I appreciate it very much. It's been a huge pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
And that has been our episode of Forgotten History. Thanks for tuning in.
Bye. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to AUP Radio, brought to you by World Radio Paris. Next up, we need to talk.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another radio installment of We Need to Talk. I'm Wetzel, and I hope everyone is having a lovely night. Mine's going great, and I'm happy to be here for another episode. So I just wanted to start off by asking, you know, like, how everyone's doing. Really take the time to ask yourself this, because For example, for me, I certainly need to start like reflecting and asking myself really, how am I doing, especially, you know, being sort of like in this rut sometimes. So you never know really what I guess self-discoveries you could make about yourself. So like after asking yourselves, you know, how you're doing and really sometimes taking the time, stepping back from a lot of the busyness and the rush of everyday life, and sometimes you're so immersed in a lot of the work and the daily bullshit of life that you seem to forget to ask yourself how you're doing, how you're operating. So yeah, really, how's everyone doing? For example, for me, like I'll tell you something, like I guess I can say I'm doing nothing in sort of the sense that I seem to be in this rut, both through like my creativity and just, you know, how much work I'm doing. Like I feel like if void or like meh or like if that was like a period of time, it would be right now, right? So it's sort of like this uninspired kind of like humdrum kind of, I guess, era of life. And I'll get to why I think it's so like, I think that kind of thing, or having that element of your life, or having that period of your life at some point, is so important, right? Why I think it's so special. But on the bright side, I feel like a lot of things are brewing in the background, you know. It's kind of analogous to when they say, like, you know, in order to make progress, you know, because, like, sometimes, you know, I go to the gym and stuff like that. So, like, people tell me, like, you know, in order to make progress. So I guess I sort of have to get into, like, my little personal trainer, my little PT bag for a second, you know, like my little nutritionist wellness zone. I'm appreciating sort of the humdrum of everyday life that I'm sort of in right now, because it's like how they say you have to sleep or take some days off from working out or the gym to truly see the progress of what you're doing. And you know, I know it's not exactly like that, but it's pretty similar, right? Like I feel like the exact same would be like if I just like got a period of time to just rest and not really sometimes bend over backwards or break my back to complete a task or to sort of get through what I need to get through, you know. So I guess I could give like a sort of like a recap of the past couple of months. And so basically a little bit of travel, you know, a little bit of student life, a little bit of just like club life as well, you know, when you're a student and you're in part of like extracurriculars, and it's like student leadership and all kinds of things like that. Sort of always demanding, always something that you need to get done, always something that you could think of getting done as well. So maybe that's a toxic mindset to have, but I feel like I'm always looking for the next thing to do. Basically just I guess like a recap. One thing that I have to like talk about is like the rising like situation of like COVID in the Netherlands, right? And it seems one thing that I've noticed is like it seems like there's like a cyclical kind of nature of the coronavirus. I'm not sure if people still call it that, but of COVID, right? And I basically talked to this professor about how like COVID will never come to a definite end. And we basically covered how there's like a possibility of there like maybe it becoming sort of something like it possibly like dwindling down to you know, it becoming like how we have to take flu shots every year or so, or maybe even like there's like a possibility of there being like a national holiday on a day where we get to like a certain threshold of vaccinations. But it seems like it's something like the echoes of that are gonna like reverberate throughout history. I'm also looking forward to Christmas, you know, warm weather, fresh fruit. You know, I'm so excited to sort of get out of Paris and get out of, because like right now like the leaves have no trees and it's all gray and it's foggy and sometimes it's gloomy and, you know, it's cold. And yeah, also that does not really contribute or help much to the to that like humdrum of everyday life, right? The sun is setting at like 5 p.m. and yeah. So I want to try something new, right? I want to try something new with the layout of We Need to Talk. I want to, I guess, be less robotic, or be a little bit more cavalier with how I approach the show and like planning, right? Like usually everything is like calculated with like the research of like the topic and also like the opinion. So it's like there's like an idea. I usually like weeks before, I usually think of like an idea and then like research it and then like opinion, and then like I formulate a really, really long script. So I have to like compile all of that together before I come on here and talk to you guys. So yeah, this script, like, it takes a while to compile and everything, and it's usually like a good like if you would imagine like a good thesis essay, like that's what the script kind of would be like points that I want to touch on. Do I want to touch on this? And then like actual like dialogue. Maybe that might be me like telling all my secrets, but whatever, you know, laying it out on all on the open for you guys. So today I want to talk. There still will be a little bit of research, because I feel like the research and just like cross checking with sources, definitely not like a sheer like opinion or like just like a blatant like, oh, going off the top of my head thing will happen. But so I want to talk about things I guess using this method, or using this new plan of being a lot less planned out, or sort of a little bit more of improvisation, but not completely, right? And also just I want to sometimes spare myself the exhaustion of creating something like a project like this. And I guess while I was thinking of this, we'll get to the topic in a second, but while I was thinking of this, it sort of made me think of like, I guess, doing the things that I do, right? And why exactly I do, like, I chose to do We Need to Talk, and basically, you know, sharing opinion and, you know, all the topics that I discuss, and basically how I find value in I guess analyzing or like critiquing like certain elements of culture and just like certain social institutions and also political institutions as well. And basically, like, you know, like this kind of stuff is like, it's real life. As much as like we try to like evade it, like we interact with it sometimes more than we interact with some people in our day-to-day life. It's a very, very big integral part of our life than sometimes we like to think of, right? So I guess as well, like I'm trying, like through this, I'm hoping to achieve, like to distance myself from a lot of theory when it comes to a lot of things. And let that not mean that I don't see the value in it, because it is extremely, extremely important. You know, theory is a way of explaining or putting a word or like a description or literalizing or verbalizing a lot of the daily or everyday experiences that we go through but can't really seem to put our finger on, right? But I want to I guess take on a more like improvised approach to it, right? Yeah, so as I was saying, sometimes, you know, like doing extracurriculars and doing even sometimes with this radio show, it can get a little bit exhausting and there can be burnout, right? Especially when you're young, right? And this is something that I'm always talking about with friends, and we're basically always talking about like being in ruts and how it seems more and more that we're getting pushed into like this state as well earlier and earlier. And there's also like the capitalist argument and just like the grind culture thing that I talked about, you know, blah, 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 that kind of thing. Like, for example, like I remember just earlier today, you know, and it's something I've also noticed, like the Snapchat, or if people, whoever still uses Snapchat on there, go on it like once a month, or maybe that's too maybe that's a little like of a low frequency than I usually do, but for like once a week, right? Like you you'll see those like little like buzz articles about, oh, 14-year-old millionaire, I'm 14 and I make $100,000 a month, or, you know, youngest millionaires and, you know, oh, I'm a investment, or like I wake up at 9 a.m. and that kind of stuff, right? The grind culture stuff that I talked about in one of the previous episodes, right? And it's crazy because sometimes people don't really talk about how exhausting it is to have a passion, right? it can really wear you down nowadays, you know. And sometimes some passions, some endeavors, just like it's not sustainable. It's not something that you can always be pursuing, or for example, especially when there are no monetary benefits, because at the end of the day, you know, like money is equal. Like I even said this in last week's episode, money is equal access, not equal, but greater access to better healthcare. If like sometimes it's just access to a system of healthcare, or even like education and food, better quality food, better clothing. In the society that we live in, money is survival, right? Doing all this, it also brings up talks about like money as well. Like when you're a college student and you're sort of at the nascence of your initiation into like real full fledged, you know, like large scale capitalism, right? Really like having discussions on money and the importance of getting remunerated and getting paid and funded for like a lot of the projects that you're doing. It's a really big and important thing, right? And the reason that I'm talking about this money is because like essentially it's work. And, you know, people, especially like family, when you tell them, oh, you know, gosh, you know, like working here, like working on my like school thing is so tired because it really feels like work. They're like, no, it's not really work. And like, no, like it really is work. Like some people don't get it. It really, sometimes I was even talking with a friend the other day and like we were saying, like, you know, sometimes it feels like you're in like a 9-to-5 kind of thing where it's like you get at school very early and you leave like, really, really late. Sometimes if you like sometimes you'll be leaving with, and you'll see like a bunch of people who are also like coming from their offices or from like their shifts, and it's really crazy because it has transformed into like an actual, sometimes even like full-time job, right?
For any listeners just joining us, you're listening to AUP Radio, brought to you by World Radio Paris. Now back to We Need to Talk.
So, burnout and like quitting. Basically, with that, like I guess what I can say with that is that sometimes I feel like it's really valuable to really distance yourself from a lot of like the work that you're doing, even if sometimes you really, really feel like you have a passion about it, because like as quite as kept like I just said, like passions can be exhausting, and it's really necessary to take a lot of quality breaks as well, because sometimes when you're running yourself ragged and you're sort of pursuing like a passion, and you're telling yourself that, you know, I need to be working and I need to be pushing and I need to be pushing the limits, because, you know, this is after all something that I'm passionate about, you know, and that's also something that has been sort of, I guess, ingrained into our mindsets, that, you know, if you're passionate about it and it's something that you love before, you really got to give it your all. Otherwise, you know, the dream is just lost. And, you know, I feel like, hey, you know, people can fall out of love and like fall out of love with a lot of things that they do. But also, you know, It's really not sustainable for anyone to always be pushing the limits and always be going the extra mile and always, I guess, like be running themselves ragged for that kind of thing, for regardless of whether or not they're passionate about something or not, right? So I had talked about social media, you know, for quite some time. I've talked about social media on We Need to Talk, and like as I mentioned previously, I had the wonderful time to talk to a professor at Webster University briefly about like tech ethics and like the importance of social media and sort of, I guess, like in like digital advocacy and also digital monitoring and within that vein, right? Things in that vein of what's like being fed to us in the media, what's being put out there, you know, with Facebook becoming Meta. I feel like now's a good time as any to really dive into basically, I think, the meaning of fame, especially looking at how social media and fame, they're not really the same thing, but they sort of, they're tethered to one another, right? And also like tabloid culture and just like, I guess, the vitriol and the animosity that is like intrinsic to sort of operating within these industries, right? And I'm going to use the example of Britney Spears because she's been making headlines, right? She's been making headlines because of the of her recent liberation from her conservatorship. And so we know Britney Spears' rise to fame, right? It was through Disney initially, and then that sort of snowballed and like escalated even more to like the superstardom, you know, the release of like for the her first records, basically like I guess mapping the four I guess major eras of her public image and her public career, right? So then from that sort of superstardom, it sort of snowballed even more to, it sort of took a left turn to like the rise of like tabloid culture and the vicious attacks from the media and the tabloid attacks and also, and sort of how that sort of operated with like in the sort of like dichotomy against like sort of the image of like her being like more sexually liberated, because essentially like she grew up from being like a teenager into like a woman within the music industry, right? And we have to look at like that example, like looking at if we're going to talk about tabloid culture as well, the more recent or at least like what I talked about like in the first episode of We Need to Talk, the Meghan Markle and British tabloid and Buckingham Palace situation, right? And looking at how valuable the market of like pain and like exploitation of strife through like within the public eye basically, and even, you know, like throughout journalism sometimes like you'll hear some people even say like, oh, you know, sometimes you have to even make the news or like make the story, right? Looking at how oftentimes it was like a cyclical kind of catch-22 like effect where the tabloid attacks contributed to even more tabloid attacks, or it would seem like it would even start like a great, like it would snowball into something even greater and greater and greater, and there were really, really was no way of putting a definite end to it or letting the rumors or the nastiness sort of fizzle out, because it operated symbiotically. It was sort of like a self-feeding mechanism or a self-feeding machine, right? So that the media basically very much contributed to the problem and essentially where we are right now, right? Because like you have this young celebrity, this young woman basically falling apart right in front of our eyes, right? And you know, no one wants to take the blame or take the responsibility essentially for what happened to her as like a young mother and her as a teenager, right? Even like now. After sort of, I guess, like this changing, this like switch of narrative of Britney Spears, it's like you even see the same sort of news outlets that are basically praising and like, you know, commemorating this event, this like sort of somewhat historical event or this somewhat amazing event. Those are the same news outlets that in some way or another profited to her downfall, right? Her world of fame, Britney Spears' world of fame, basically like this like insulated fame bubble like became polluted very quickly, right? In around the mid 2000s, right? So the media is capturing all these vulnerable moments of the starlet and basically eating up her downfall, right? That kind of thing was just so commonplace. And I remember even before 2007, even before 2007, like how popular tabloids were, just like speaking on the sheer nature of how tabloids had become so commonplace, and that was like really, really a big, big industry, right? I remember how popular things like People Magazine or like the Us Weekly was like it really, really, it was crazy, right? And looking at how now just like things have changed, like I remember like being in a grocery store and you could not escape the yellows and the pinks and the bright colors and the pop, like the bubble letters, or I'm not even sure if it was bubble letters, but you know, like the attracting, like the like the marketing through like magazines and like all the kind of stuff, and like the celebrity images that were plastered across all kinds of magazines, basically meant to like pull your eyes into like the mass aisles of like of like tabloid attacks and like false half-baked critiques on celebrities who really, really, like, oftentimes, sometimes didn't even know, like half the stuff was being, like, written or said about them, right? And it's really funny, or I guess kind of as well surprising to see how the media since then has sort of changed, or I guess now it's moved on a lot more to social media as well. It can be attributed to social media, but just seeing the shift or the lack of representation, not representation, but like the lack of presence of that kind of style of media, and like the of tabloids essentially, right? So yeah, basically like so many like there were so many primary colors, so many yellows, so many reds, you know, like so many like buzzwords and exclamation marks on very nasty hate inducing or hate mongering titles or hate mongering headers on these magazines like plastered for everyone to see, and they were like mass distributed, right? And every and I guess from my standpoint, like I always remember like craving or wanting to know exactly what was being said in those, because I guess looking at the image, the words exactly, or like the message doesn't really match up with like the image of the color schemes that were being used in those magazines. It was very like there was this very, very big jarring dichotomy between the actual like what met your eyes and like what your brain actually ended up reading, like the words that were actually on the cover, the words that were even on the page, right? So yeah, anyways, I digress. Basically, like I feel like that's the kind of thing that like stresses or like the push or the magnitude of like social media as well, like looking at how it sort of shifted, how tabloids and like and magazine culture sort of shifted now into social media and like chat rooms and comment section, things like that. It also brings up the point of how, like, you know, people who always say, oh, you know, social media is not real, or it's on your head, or it's on your head, or it's in your phone. Like, you know, it very much is real, right? Because of the fact that who's interacting with each other on social media, it's the people at the end of the day. So as much as, yes, it is like a virtual landscape, it very much is representative of the real world. And so the reason why you have a person of such fame who's targeted, right, especially like Britney Spears, I feel like that's a very unique case, looking at where she was from, how old she was, essentially because she was an easy target. You know, she was young, she was nice, like rich, conventionally attractive, that kind of thing. And also like her southernness. And then there's also like an issue of having like a support system, right? What's now coming to light is that there was like a lack of a support system, basically, which is what made her like, I guess, such a susceptible victim of like the vicious attacks from the media, right? And what we're now seeing basically is that her family wasn't shit. Really, really, like her family, they ain't shit. Like her support system has always been terrible since day one, right? Fame, it brings up that like a certain point where it's like fame, especially like the rags to riches. Maybe not rags per se, but like fame, where you're sort of like a singular, where you represent like a singular body or entity of fame within your family, is a very dangerous, slippery slope. Especially when you have people around you who treat you almost like a cash machine in sort of a way, and that kind of thing is represented by this situation, right? Where where recently, like you know, we're learning that even like her own sister was profiting off of like the result or like this sort of downfall, right? Like, you know, like she couldn't even drive herself, own her own electronics, and her own family was eating from that. You know, I think all of this is also, like, you know, a really great example of what it means to be, like, a private person, right? You know, when you're, like, a celebrity, you know, you have, like, I guess, like, different tiers of celebrities, or like different taxonomies of celebrities, where you have like the like the normal celebrity, like the everyday celebrity, and then there's like micro celebrities, and then there's like the private celebrities, right? Part of it also like came from part of like that vitriol as well. I feel like when there's like the potential for fame is when you like reject or try your best to not appear in the public eye, despite the fact that the public eye is focused on you, or essentially the fact that these tabloids and this fame has given you this opportunity. You know, it's sort of like it comes from a place, I guess, of like of hate, because it seems as if like one is being like ungrateful. I guess that's sort of the psychology behind it, when really I feel like there is like a gross entitlement of the public to random people. To random people and like their private life, right? So before we get into that, we could also get into like I guess the punishment as well of Britney's sexuality, right? We could basically looking at how that also had that was like responsible for a lot of like the imprecations Britney and her Britney like received, and like even to this day sometimes even continues to receive, right? And just generally, and not just her, like the early 2000s, like that, or that time was like a very vicious time to be like a member of any marginalized community, because of how commonplace and how profitable it was to basically be shat on by like the public, right? Like even like movies and TV shows, it was like so commonplace to basically not respect, or to not be politically correct, I guess. Yeah. So it seemed like there was like this market of exploitation, or of sometimes even just like blatant discrimination of women, of LGBTQ, of Black women, of even sometimes neurodivergence and disabled people. That was this big market. And, you know, back then it was just, I guess, as more and more people became more socially conscious, it's become less and less acceptable, right? But back then it was very, very vicious time to be present, or to be like cognizant of like the public sphere, like the public media, right? Yeah, but the media really, really crave to see Britney's downfall. And also, like, it brings up the question of, like, psychologically, like, what was it? You know, because I feel like the group psychology is not necessarily, like the phenomena, it really ain't, it's not crabs in the bucket. Because, like, some people who were at the same, sort of in that same, I guess, echelon, or in that same realm or industry, in that same level of fame, sometimes would even speak out against her and rooted for her downfall, right? And further, like, rooted for essentially what was like the first, or not the first, but definitely essentially what was one of the biggest, earliest moments of like cancel culture that we got to see. You know, like, I feel like she was a victim of that before cancel culture existed, right? And something I guess then needs to be said about like assigning, like, very, very much looking at how nowadays it's almost, just to go off on a tangent, but nowadays it's almost as if the term cancel culture has been used almost to evade any cultural or political responsibility from really famous people, because it seems like no one ever wants to acknowledge how she seemed to be one of the first victims, of cancel culture. But nowadays it seems as if cancel culture is being used just as like a, oh, you know, I should be allowed to be careless and responsible with my platform. So therefore, I'm gonna tout the, like, you know, this sort of victim narrative of I'm getting canceled and there's cancel culture at play here against me. When the reality is, it's everything but, you know, like sometimes I guess essentially it's just an easier way, in a nutshell, to evade any like cultural responsibility. So looking at the change in like social and political discourse, right? That has sort of happened since back then on like basically on how we talk about women and women's bodies and sexuality, right? Back then, like hate on women and misogyny like was like a market, right? The sheer amount of hate that was marketed and the lack of responsibility as well was like astounding and astonishing. It was like this big well-oiled machine, right? And then there was also like attitudes towards like sex and body positivity, and looking at how that has changed, right? People really really saw these like systems or saw these molds as ways to regulate women's behavior, but also further it was like any sort of deviation slightly led to this kind of led to sort of the sheer like response that we see, the sheer like hateful response that we see from media, and nowadays I guess it's sort of transformed into the world of social media, right? So I also like fully believe that people were rooting for her downfall like before the year of 2007, right? Like that kind of like amassing that kind of fame, right? And like the tabloids and like had existed before 2007, and like magazines have existed before 2007, right? When she had basically reached the zenith of teen stardom, right? And like that initial record release in that music video, like people had condemned her for being too sexual or being like that way on a stage, right? And it's also sort of interesting how it was almost as if like the same thing that people loved the most was also the same thing that they hated the most in the same hand. And there was even like photo shoots as well, you know, that added to that added fuel to that fire. And there's so much that can be said about teenage fame and like child stars and teenage celebrities and adult celebrities, whereas personally I feel like child stardom or even like sometimes even like teenage stardom is really really something that needs to be like strictly and heavily monitored, if like not exist at all, because I feel like there is no way that that kind of thing cannot result in just a dumpster fire, you know, teenage fame, that is. I feel like there's no way that that can yield like a very valuable, not toxic, kind of not problematic, not detrimental future for someone. So basically just like the sheer amount of like animus that Britney Spears faced from like receiving that level of fame at such a young age as well, you know, it was parents, I feel like, which is also so interesting, where you look at how there is almost this responsibility that is put upon people who sometimes are not even that much older than certain children, where it's like you have parents expecting, not wanting to take responsibility for what, like when parenting their own children and leaving it all to someone who, like at that time, even nowadays that sort of thing still happens. Like it's like we have parents not wanting to take responsibility for actually like parenting their children, or like being there and like teaching their children like I guess to simplify it, like right from wrong in that sort of sense. So I guess it all boils down to looking at how like the cultural fixation and like the need to put put like celebrities and like people who are subjected to fame under a microscope, it really is like a subjection, right? I don't think that kind of thing has ever been seen before in that sort of like a magnitude, the same way that it was with Britney. Because there was really like it seemed like there was like a cultural need to overanalyze and to always be watching her, right? And you know what I think is funny is you know, the people who you would expect to come to Britney's defense not only didn't do that, but took it a step further to shame her for sort of claiming as well, like I guess among other things, to claiming the rightful agency over her own body, right? Society basically like had a chance to make amazing social declarations and changes in social discourse on the and just like basically like precisely saving women and just saving society like a good decade and a half in like the body positivity movement and ushering in like the sexual liberation a good decade earlier, or because now we've definitely seen it come up through social media, and I guess this was in the mid 2010s, right? Through social media and a lot of the movements, right? There was a good chance that social discourse could have advanced or made I guess a good 10 years of progress way earlier than we have in reality. There was a good chance that could have happened. You know, there were points even we were on the precipice, or we were on just on the cusp of making really, really great points about sexualization and, you know, the exploitation of young girls in the media and in the entertainment industry, and the sexual freedom of women, right? We were almost there, but then instead of hating, you know, the corrupt, male-dominated music industry, instead of doing that, we decided to blame Britney Spears. We decided to blame the victims of these systems and of these tabloids, right? And there was, honestly, apart from it being laziness, it also goes on to show how, a lot of times we fail to apply critical thought to a lot of the ways that we interact with the images that we consume daily. We fail to read or we fail to see or to critically analyze a lot of these images, to see them really, really for what they are, as a way to hate monger against people in society who honestly aren't as powerful as we like to make them out to be, because at the end of the day, fame and celebrities are just sometimes they're just intangible constructs, and these people are actually people, right? And sort of that same thing is also what happened to Kesha, right? Instead of blaming the sleazy music executives profited off of her pain, they turned around and started pointing the finger at her, you know? And, you know, after all that, I really believe that it'd be really, I guess, remiss, or it'd be really irresponsible for there to not be a really, really big movement around, or a really big, big movement around decentering a lot of the power that social media has over just celebrities, or even just over celebrity life and celebrity culture, and just that just looking at just the sheer amount of responsibility that can be given to the tabloid magazines, and a lot of the fault that they have in playing, or the role that they had in the downfall of a lot of celebrities as well. I mean, that same thing also happened to you know, Janet Jackson, and even just continues to happen on smaller scales to other celebrities. So yeah, thank you so much for joining me on We Need to Talk. This has been a fun, really insightful episode. Also looking at it and researching and everything. I really had a really great time. Thanks so much for joining me. I hope you guys have a nice and wonderful night.
Thank you so much for listening to AUP Radio's 32nd episode of the semester. If you'd like to hear more, you can tune in here on World Radio Paris every day, Monday through Thursday, from 9 to 10 p.m. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or even an idea for a show that you'd like to hear us do, you can DM us on Instagram. We're at AUP Radio. This episode was produced by Nicole DeSante, Clark Marchese, and myself, your host, Kira Roddy. Music by Vicade Studios. Enjoy your night.